Reviving the religion of redemption, as we saw in our last message in this series, became part of a much broader effort to restore the worship of Jehovah to its former vigor. Young King Hezekiah was not content with a token ritual, however sincere, as though the reinstitution of the temple worship would be sufficient in itself. His heart rejoiced in that reinstitution of that sacrificial worship, but his heart longed for a more complete work, a more complete repudiation of the apostasy that his father spread across the kingdom. It appears that there were no records to show precisely how long it had been since a major Passover celebration occurred at Jerusalem. To be sure, the people did not forsake the observance of the Passover completely. Not everyone followed the apostasy. But it seems that any major efforts to keep the feast in Jerusalem grew increasingly rare, especially during the reign of Ahaz. Certainly, it was the case that not since the division of the kingdom in Rehoboam's reign, centuries earlier, had there been any effort to invite the people from the northern tribes, those 10 tribes that went and formed their own kingdom. So to invite the people from those tribes to come back to join the feast in Jerusalem. The king understood that the keeping of the Passover, and I'm struck by the timing of our message this evening because we are coming into the Passover season here in our calendar. But he understood that the keeping of the Passover was important not only for the actual remembrance of God's miraculous deliverance in the days of Moses, but also for the powerfully unifying force the Passover was designed to be among all the descendants of Israel. But even setting those considerations aside, Hezekiah committed himself to being a man of the book. And he knew that the scriptures commanded the annual observance of the Passover so that the people would not forget what God did for their ancestors or for the establishment of his people in the land of promise. It was this last consideration that I mentioned more than the others that were also compelling that motivated the young king to devote his energy and prestige to this cause. He had just assumed the throne. And so one of the first things that he was going to do that was going to reach beyond the boundaries of his own kingdom was this effort to revive the Passover. The house of the Lord was back in operation in Jerusalem, and so the king understood it was appropriate that the temple be the focus of a truly national reassertion of the keeping of the Passover. In every aspect of this observance, we find that the king was more interested in observing the requirements of the scriptures than he was just in resurrecting any kind of religious form for its own sake. So, he continued his reformation of Jewish society in this effort and showed again that he was endeavoring to follow the policy of adhering to the word. And I want you to think upon that theme with me this evening, adhering to the word. The approach that marked the career of King Hezekiah was that he sought to return the word of the Lord to its place of prominence and honor at the center of the life of the people. He was committed to being a man of the book, and it was his desire that the people should be characterized by that same motive. The thing that made him unique, and we've already commented upon that fact, made him unique among all the kings of Judah, was that he cared genuinely to be conformed to the commandments of the Lord. There was no king like him, before him, or after him, the scriptures have told us. As we will see, he did not always succeed in staying by that lofty standard. But we may say certainly that his intention from the beginning was that the standards of the divine word should be his guide in his service to Jehovah. So, in verse 12, the verse ends with the statement that it was by the word of the Lord. It's significant in connection with this desire that Hezekiah had that much of the material about the king's reign that appears in 2 Chronicles has to do with his reformation of the kingdom's religious life, so that it came much more closely under the precepts of the Lord. In fact, as we will find, it is not until 2 Chronicles 32 that there is any reference to what we would consider to be the typical things you would read about a king, his actions in terms of foreign policy and military operations. The narrative in 2 Kings is about those duties nearly exclusively. And those events took place later in the king's reign. That's why we're spending our time here, because the beginning of his reign was characterized by this desire to reform the religious life of the kingdom. It should be apparent that Hezekiah's desire from the beginning was to lead such a sweeping, such an extensive revival that the memories of his father's reign would fade away, that they would come to resemble the nightmare that he knew his father's reign had been. We can learn a lot from King Hezekiah. You see, whatever the questions of civic policy are, questions of war or peace, questions of general and domestic welfare or justice or whatever they are, if we do not govern ourselves according to the dictates of the scriptures, then we will make errors in judgment at every step of the journey. It is a good point for us in our daily living. Whatever your responsibilities are, and you have different responsibilities every day, wherever those responsibilities direct your steps each day, if you are committed to the rule of divine truth, the word of the Lord in your life, then you will proceed judiciously and carefully, especially when others may be trying to lead you into error. So in this passage this evening, we may highlight three powerful results of adhering to the Word. And just let me interject before I get into those things, just in case I forget it later on, that really the significance of the Passover from the perspective of the king was that it set forth the reality of the Redeemer. The Passover was a picture of the Redeemer. And so Hezekiah recognized that the Passover was not only a backward look for the people to that blessing of deliverance that their ancestors knew, but it was also a reminder to them of the word of the prophets that the Redeemer, the Passover Lamb, was going to come. So that was also, I believe, in the king's mind. He understood not only the historic significance of the Passover, but the prophetic significance. Now let us come to these three powerful results of adhering to the word. First, purity above tradition. Purity above tradition. If King Hezekiah was anxious to restore and preserve the old traditions of the calendar when it came to the Passover, he would have hastened to hold the Passover celebration in the first month, because the command of the word was that it be held then. And that went back all the way to the time of Moses. Let's turn back to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. And verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. And then beginning at verse 3 and following is the instruction regarding how the Passover was to be observed. Till you come down to verse 7, where you find, they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper doorpost of the houses wherein they shall eat it. So the Lord said, this month is to be the beginning of months. And later in Exodus, just a chapter or two afterward, you find the requirement that every year at that time they should observe the Passover. So here was a precept that was one of the foundational principles in any understanding of Judaism. The first month of the year, on the 10th day of the month, would begin the Passover. So, just to illustrate, to deviate from that understanding would be like suggesting that we should observe Independence Day on August 4th. Instead of July 4th. Now, a suggestion like that would meet with incredulity. What do you mean? How can we do that? We've always marked it on that date. But you see, the king understood that there were practical considerations. The efforts to cleanse and restore the temple to its proper state and use consumed so much time in the first month that there would be no way for them to observe the Passover at the prescribed time. There would be no way for them to even plan for the celebration. And he also understood, as we have read here, that the priests who were to lead the ceremonies were not prepared for their responsibilities. If you look at verse 3, they could not keep it at that time because the priests had not sanctified themselves sufficiently. They had not sanctified themselves sufficiently. That is, it was not just the temple that had been allowed to be degraded during the previous years. The priests themselves had not given their attention to their own responsibilities. And so there was much about their own personal preparation, sanctifying themselves, that the revelation of God required of them. And they recognized, and the king recognized, they were not ready. So the king recognized that the Passover could not be observed at its traditional time. Even though in the feeling of religious awakening, people might have really wanted to have it then, he recognized that they could not have it then. Yet even here, and I want you to see this because it shows to us the extent to which Hezekiah had made a study of the scriptures. The king knew the full scope of divine revelation on this matter. So let's turn back to the book of Numbers. The king was familiar with all of the law. Numbers chapter 9. And verse 9. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, If any man of you or of your posterity shall be unclean by reason of a dead body, or be in a journey afar off, yet he shall keep the Passover unto the Lord, the 14th day of the second month. At even they shall keep it, and eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. That is, here the Lord was saying, there may be situations where people cannot keep the Passover at the traditional or commanded time, and in those cases, they may keep it later. And Hezekiah knew that part of the law as well. So the king was not making it up here. He was not embarking on an ad hoc measure. Even here, he was endeavoring to adhere to the word of the Lord. Now that's a powerful lesson for us. The word emphasizes adherence to it, purity above all else. So whatever is needed to achieve that required purity is worth more to us than an adherence to some kind of calendar tradition. Now, this was a one-time change. In subsequent years, they would have adhered to that tradition that it would be in the first month because that was adhering to the word. But Hezekiah was very anxious that for this restoration of the Passover to the central life of the people, everything should be in readiness. So they began their work of making the preparations. They didn't have a lot of time to plan, but they began. And that brings me to the second thing that we see here, the second aspect of adhering to the word, submission above stubbornness. Submission above stubbornness. So they resolved that they were going to send out a letter. This was a royal letter. This was an appeal from the people through the king. And the appeal that was to be sent out called for submission. There was going to be a call to people in Israel from Beersheba even to Dan, that is from the southern part of the kingdom of the northern kingdom, all the way up to the north to Dan, that all of the people there were going to be exhorted to come to Jerusalem to keep this Passover. They had not done it of a long time in such sort as it was written, and the idea there is, probably they had not done it in the numbers that Hezekiah envisioned would be present on this occasion. So they sent this appeal out. Now, let's just remember the history. Hezekiah became the king of Judah in the third year of the reign of Hoshea, the king of Israel. Hoshea was the last king of Israel, and we know that he reigned for 9 years. So Hezekiah's reign occupied the last years in the kingdom of Israel. That is, already the kingdom of Israel was in serious decline, and it was soon to be overrun. So this call then went to the people throughout the northern kingdom to travel to Jerusalem to join in the Passover celebration, effectively going back to their roots religiously, spiritually. That is, it was an appeal to them. While it wasn't stated in so many words, it was an appeal to them to turn away from the religion of the golden calves that Jeroboam the First instituted way back at the beginning of the northern kingdom's existence. He set up those calves, one at Dan in the north, one at Bethel in the south, so the people could worship there instead of going to Jerusalem. So this was an appeal to them to turn away from that religion. Notice how the appeal is put. In verse 7, "Be not ye like your fathers and like your brethren which trespassed against the Lord God of their fathers, who therefore gave them up to desolation as ye see." They were saying, already your kingdom is under God's judgment. But in verse 8, they said, "Be ye not stiff-necked as your fathers were. Yield yourselves unto the Lord." This was a genuine entreaty. "Serve the Lord your God, that the fierceness of his wrath may turn away from you." That is, do not be stubborn and stiff-necked. It's a striking expression. It finds its exposition in the next to the last book of the Old Testament, the prophecy of Zechariah, and chapter 7. Zechariah chapter 7. In the portion that begins at verse 8, the word of the Lord is going to the people, telling them what to do and what not to do. But we read the response in verse 11, "But they refused to hearken and pulled away the shoulder and stopped their ears that they should not hear. Yea, they made their hearts as an adamant stone, lest they should hear the law and the words which the Lord of hosts hath sent in his spirit by the former prophets." So there's the picture. They refused to hearken. They stiffened their necks. They pulled away the shoulder. Any parent knows the reality of that vivid language. When a child pulls away the shoulder. So the appeal to them was, don't do that. Don't be stiff-necked. Because the promise in verse 9 was, if you will come to the Passover, if you will come back to the Lord, you will find the Lord to be gracious. You find that appeal in verse 9. "The Lord your God is gracious and merciful and will not turn away his face from you if ye return unto him." So here was an appeal to the people of the northern kingdom to take their stand again on the old ground of the truth. to rest on the mercy and grace of God, to rest on the promise of God to forgive and to pardon. And that's always the appeal of the word of the Lord to us in our own time. It is an appeal not to be stiff-necked. It is an appeal to submit to that which the word entreats. And that leads me to the third thing that we encounter here. Humility above cynicism. Humility above cynicism. So they sent this appeal out, and they sent it in the mail. Except the mail was in the hands of riders, the posts. So we read in verse 10, the posts passed from city to city. They were carrying the mail throughout the tribal areas of the kingdom of Israel. And they delivered the message. And what was the response? The response was mockery. The response in verse 10 was they laughed them to scorn. They laughed them to scorn. That is, it was not just a little chuckle. They laughed out loud. They laughed them to scorn. Oh, that's a good one. They mocked them. They derided them. The old cynicism that had been bred by the false religion in Israel for all those years was still alive. The old expression of apostate religion was still in power, still holding sway in spite of all of the calamities that had befallen the people. There was the cynicism. But we find in verse 11 that some did not follow that course. Some humbled themselves. Nevertheless, divers of Asher and Manasseh and of Zebulun humbled themselves. And what was the evidence that they humbled themselves? They got up. They got their belongings together that they needed for the journey, and they went to Jerusalem. Now you talk about something that was a break with tradition. Most of these people had never been to Jerusalem. They had been taught for generations that we worship at Dan or at Bethel, at the golden calf. We don't go to Jerusalem to worship. That was the forerunner, if you think of it, of the attitude of the woman at the well, whom Jesus met in John chapter 4. And she said, you know, you say that in Jerusalem is the place where we ought to worship, but our fathers say that, no, it's in this mountain that you are to worship. That had its roots in the policy of Jeroboam. So now these people, when they heard this entreaty, here was the amazing thing. They got organized and they went to Jerusalem. They joined in the worship there. They joined in the Passover. And we read that in addition to that response, in the southern kingdom, in the kingdom of Judah, there was a much broader response to the entreaty, which also circulated through that kingdom. So we read in verse 12 that the hand of God in Judah was to give them one heart to do the commandment of the king and of the princes by the word of the Lord. So there was a much greater response. The people demonstrated a heart to serve the Lord, to obey his word. They humbled themselves. So in the face of the cynicism and the mockery and the scorn, some said, you know, that is an entreaty that we need to follow. We need to go to Jerusalem. We need to join there in the Passover celebration, remembering what I said earlier, that it was not just looking back. It was not just for the sake of remembering history. There was value in that, certainly. But it was also looking forward. The Passover lamb was going to come. The Redeemer was going to come. So they humbled themselves and obeyed the word of the Lord. So here is the fruit of adhering to the word. It is that heart to follow after the Lord. So what a blessing it was for the king then to see all these people gathering together for the Passover celebration, and knowing that here he had established a new template, if you will, for the business of the kingdom, that the first thing was going to be, what does the word of the Lord say? I say to you, we could pray that God would raise to places of power in our land people who that would have that as their chief concern. What does the word of the Lord say? Let us govern according to that precept, according to that template. But let us follow it in our own lives. What does the word of the Lord say? Let us adhere then to the word. And in adhering to the word, we will find the blessing again of the grace and mercy of God in our lives.